the Iranian youth of that are so in love with literature of the world that they are prepared to go to jail for it. A lot of the books I taught, we had one copy and we Xeroxed hundreds of pages in order to be able to study. You know, sometimes we talk about complacency and comfort. That is what gets me, that the young people here have never felt.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Professor of Literature Asar Nafisi. Asar lives in Washington, D.C., but she is born in Iran. She is the author of the bestseller Reading Lolita in Tehran, a memoir in books, and that book came in 2003, and it spent over 117 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and has been translated into 32 languages. And last year, she published Read Dangerously. And today we will explore the relationship between literature and politics. Asar spent half of her professional life at Iranian universities as a teacher and has the last 25 years had different prominent positions, including a fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., where she was a professor of aesthetics, culture, and literature, and taught courses on the relation between culture and politics. Of course, I could have mentioned many other things, but I will now welcome my guest. Welcome online from Washington, D.C., Asar.
Thank you, Mathilde. It's a pleasure to meet you and to have this conversation.
Yeah, likewise. To the listeners, I have recorded this episode with Asar Nafisi a couple of weeks ago, but right after we recorded, we got the message about the death of a young girl in Tehran, and she was killed because she wasn't wearing her headscarf, hijab, properly. And after that, many things has happened and many demonstrations have occurred all over the country. And before we talk about the things that we were supposed to talk about, Asar, I just have to ask you, what are your thoughts about what's happening right now in your home country?
You know, Mathilde, I feel two very contradictory emotions. On one hand, I feel so outraged and so angered at the violent way that this regime is trying to oppress Iranian people's demands for freedom. The violence they're using against these young people is just beyond imagination. I can't imagine. On the other hand, I feel very hopeful because of the Iranian people's struggles and resistance. This resistance that you see right now is rooted in this resistance that Iranian women and Iranian people showed from the very beginning of the revolution. I don't know how many people remember that at the beginning of the revolution, when Ayatollah Khomeini gave a fatwa about women wearing the veil, hundreds of thousands of Iranian women came into the streets. And to those who said that the laws of the Islamic Republic regarding women are part of Iran's traditions and history, they responded no. And their slogan was, freedom is neither Western nor Eastern. Freedom is universal. So we see now we have reached a turning point in these struggles. Usually what happens, the protest happens, the regime comes with violence and suppresses their protests. Then again, a year or two, we see another protest happening. This time more developed, more people participate. With this one, people from all walks of lives, from many, many cities around Iran have participated. And they have refused to go home despite the fact that they are killing them. This is the sign that this regime has failed. It is using the violence because it has no other weapon in its arsenal. Only violence is language. This regime has failed and it is scared. It is scared of the Iranian people, and the Iranian people know their power. They know their power, especially the women. So I hope for the day when Iranian women come into the streets of the cities dressed the way they want to, not the way they have been ordered to.
And finally, Yazar, is there anything we can do?
Yes, there is. We need to give voice to the voices coming out of Iran. We need to participate in the protests that are happening all around the world. But most important, we should not let this die in the news. This is not something that we only ask the states. We do ask the democratic governments to support these protests and to condemn the violence. But that is not enough. This is a people thing. We need American and European and people from all over the world to come behind the Iranian people and the Iranian women. We need the progressive movements to make a move in support of this movement.
Let's just hope then, Nassar, that next time we talk, it's become a better situation for women in Iran. And as the listeners will hear in the rest of this episode, Azar knows a lot about the history of Iran, and she knows what it is to be in a country where women are not free and how it is to be doing things in secret. So I hope you will listen through and also read the books that Azar has written about these things. Thank you, Azar, for this comment.
But let's start with an intriguing quote that I read in your book, and that's from your latest book. You said, yeah. Reading and writing have protected me through the worst moments of my life, through loneliness, terror, doubt, and anxiety. How?
Well, if I have to tell you about that, I have to tell you the story of my life. Because, you know, as soon as I became conscious of myself and of the world around me, I lived with stories. I mean, I was about 3 and a half when every night my father would tell me stories, and he was very generous and democratic in his choice of stories. One night we would be with our epic poet Ferdowsi and Iran's mythologies, and the next night we'll go to Denmark with Little Match Girl, to France with Little Prince, to England with Alice, to America with Charlotte's Web. So before I traveled the world, I had already been there through the stories that I heard from my father and later read myself. At the age of 13, I was sent to England to continue my studies. It was the first shock I had of what exile means, what it means to be all of a sudden taken away from everything you called home. And in order to feel at home, I took with me 3 books of poetry. Iranians identify a great deal with their poetry. They're very proud of it, and poetry is part of our life. I took with me our 2 great classical poets, Hafez and Rumi, and a feminist poet whom the Islamic Republic very much hated and banned, Furugh Farrokhzad. So that is how I realized I can take my portable world with me, that no matter where in the world I am, that world's literature would be my friend. The characters in Jane Austen and Charles Dickens and Thackeray and later in America with Melville and Hawthorne and Toni Morrison and James Baldwin, these characters were all my kith and kin. They were my cousins and my siblings, and you know, so that is how I made myself at home. Mm-hmm. And when I went back to Iran after the revolution, when everything seemed so alien and where freedom of speech and freedom of association was taken away from us, I connected to my students and I connected to my people through fiction. Through works of fiction. I couldn't talk about individual choice and lack of it in Iran, but I could talk about how in Jane Austen's novels, a woman is always at the center of the story. And that woman refuses to act according to the mores and norms of her society, saying, I marry the man I choose. I will not be chosen, but I choose. And that is still a revolutionary idea. So everywhere I went, one thing is constant, apart from the love of family and friends, that is the companionship of imagination and ideas.
But it also seemed a little wise, I think, because when you were teaching in Iran, you told you could use these books, fiction, but you could at the same time tell your students and yourself things that you couldn't say straight out because of fear for consequences. But you could do that through literature.
Yeah, I mean, that is why I believe that great literature is always subversive. I could have chosen a revolutionary writer to talk about, but I chose on purpose someone like Jane Austen, whom nobody would think of as revolutionary. Yet she represents a revolution through women that we are fighting for right now as we speak in different parts of the world. You know, so I wanted to show that fiction by nature, by structure, is democratic. It is made of different characters, all confronting one another, and as well as befriending one another, having dialogues and exchanges with one another. But the writer has to go under the skin of every character and become that character. And every character has a voice, even the villain. In real life, we want to eliminate villains. In fiction, we confront them. We don't evade them, you know. And we try to understand them in order to be able to confront them. For me, fiction became a way of questioning the world and questioning myself, becoming self-critical.
This is very interesting. And you also have another author who lives in, of course, also in the Middle East. He lives in Israel, David Grossman. And he chooses what he calls the literary approach, which you understand as literature is an act of resistance against something he called dehumanization. Is that also why you write yourself a resistance?
Definitely. Because, you know, in reality, a lot of times it is difficult not to dehumanize others. You know, I remember when I was in Iran, there were moments when I would wish everyone in power dead. Of course, I wouldn't go and kill anyone. And I would really not, at the bottom of my heart, I would not really want to wish death upon anyone, even the villains, you know. But it was the frustration of the moment. And sometimes you permanently stay frustrated. You know, you become like your enemy. They dehumanize us. When Donald Trump talks about the media in America being enemy of the people, one is reminded of Stalin and his definition of enemy of the people or of Hitler. They all reduced not just their enemies, but those that were different from them. They reduced them to not human. I remember reading Stalin's History of the Bolshevik Party, and in that he talks about the enemies as insects and cockroaches and rats, you know. So the language of fiction is the language of ambiguity, of doubt, of opacity, of complexity, but it is not the language of dehumanization. And Grossman is really afraid of becoming that. You can see it in his words. So I thought he's a good example of why a writer would want to be a witness to truth and stand up to the dehumanization.
Because when it comes to Grossman, in your latest book, which you have to explain a little bit, you are writing letters to your father, and he died in 2004. So obviously you are writing to your dead father.
Yes.
And the title that you chose for your book is Read Dangerously. And I can tell the listeners that it's actually kind of organized through different authors that you have chosen, and you are telling your father about different things through these letters. So tell me a bit about the background here and what you are exactly doing through this book.
Well, again, we were talking about frustration. For the past few years, I have been living in a state of constant frustration. You know, if you go to my books, like before this book, Reading Dangerously, my last book, the book I wrote, Republic of Imagination, was about the negligence and indifference that democracies are showing towards imagination and idea. And will a democracy survive without imagination and ideas, you know? So that was a question that had preoccupied me for a long, long time. And I got to the point where, like the character in Saul Bellow's there's this character in Saul Bellow's book by the name of Herzog, and he starts writing letters to everybody. I was in I usually, when I get to this state, I write and I read. So with this book, I started writing, but I was writing in letters. I wrote my father as well as others. But it was too random. I didn't know what to do from Abraham Lincoln to Toni Morrison to my dad to Donald Trump. They were all there. So I thought, okay, let's bring some order to this. So I started writing to the writers themselves. But that didn't work either because it was artificial. I mean, I telling Margaret Atwood, oh, this is what your book is all about, you know. So it didn't work. And I was talking to a good friend of mine, and I said, I'm just looking for a way to write these letters. And she said, why don't you write to a third person? And immediately, almost, my father came to my mind. because he and I have had this exchange about literature since I was a child. And he wrote me the first time he wrote me, I still have his diary. He wrote in his diary addressed to me, and I was only 4 years old. And he talks about where he is at now, why he's writing to me, what he expects of the future for us, you know. And the first time I wrote him, he was in the United States getting his master's degree, and I was 6 years old, and I would write on scraps of paper, signing them, calling him dearest Baba, and signing them your daughter. He wrote me long letters, which I didn't understand partly. But in one of them, he said, maybe one day we will turn our letters into a book, you know. And so there was this long history of writing to him. And I chose him as my interlocutor.
So, because it all, of course, it always connects back to Iran, even though you were living in the United States now. And of course, in both two countries, you have a history now. You have about 20, 25 years in the United States, and you also stayed in the United States to study when you were young.
Yes.
So you've been there, but you went back to Iran, and of course, that was difficult because, as you mentioned, it was after the revolution. I mean, that is something else than staying there before the revolution. And your father was even jailed at some point, but that was before the revolution. So it was a tough history in many aspects.
Yes, his jail was sort of a turning point in my life. Up until then, I mean, he was the mayor of Tehran, one of the most popular and the youngest mayor. And I was studying in Switzerland, and one morning they called me to the principal's office to tell me my father has been arrested. And I couldn't understand it. I thought there had been a revolution. So anyway, they escorted me to the airport, and I went back to Iran, and I discovered that he had been in jail. My family, they are terrible politicians. They don't know how to be a politician. My father had stood up despite the advice of everyone that you need a backing. You can't go into this alone. He went into it alone, and he stood up to the two most powerful men in Iran, apart from the Shah, which were the prime minister and the minister of interior. So they trumped up some charges against him and put him in jail. They sent him a message saying that if you apologize for your foolhardiness, for your obstinacy, you can leave and everything will be okay. And he responded that I want to stay in jail until I defend myself. So they said, you want to stay in jail? You stay in jail. And he stayed in a place they called temporary jail. It was the library. His room was the jail's library. And from jail, in order to keep himself and not give in, he started on his own to learn a new language. He started learning Russian, and he translated poems from French and English. He read a great deal, and he wrote a great deal. At the end of Read Dangerously, I have an appendix, which is one of his letters. Was an open letter to President Johnson of the United States, which I put there. But that is how he kept himself. When the time for his trial came, He began his defense by reading from our great epic poet Ferdowsi. And his defense is full of quotations from all over the world, from Victor Hugo and Eluard to, you know, all to our own Persian writers and poets. And they had to exonerate him of all charges. At first, they said he's exonerated of all charges except insubordination. And we were very proud of it. Our father was insubordinate. You know, we all wanted to be insubordinate. But later they took that back as well. And, you know, they cleared him of all charges.
So, but then, of course, a couple of decades or a decade or two later, it was really serious because then the revolution came. And in the intro again, you say, in Iran, like all totalitarian states, the regime pays too much attention to poets and writers. And that means it's dangerous to be poets and writers in a regime like that. And they are harassing them, jailing them, and even killing them. And your father, of course, he was not a writer and he wasn't killed, but that happened to a lot of other people after the revolution. But you also say that the problem in America, which is, I mean, on the other side, is that they pay too little attention to writers.
Yes.
They are silenced, but not by torture and jail, but by indifference. And you say that you are reminded of James Baldwin's claim, neither love nor terror makes one blind, indifference makes one blind. So the question is, can you tell me a little bit about those two different approaches to writers? And also if we have been blind in the West to be so complacent also in politics?
Wow.
Wow, it's difficult.
These are great questions. We could talk about them all day. Well, to begin with, recently the tragic case of Salman Rushdie again, where this guy attacked him and
almost killed him. Yes,
almost killed him. Now, that I mention in my book because I begin the book with the chapter on Salman Rushdie, actually, I asked this question in my book, that what is it about these men and women, these writers, whose only weapon is their words? They have no army behind them. They have no weapons that they use. What is it about them that is so frightening to some of the most powerful men on earth, that they want to not just ban them, but to physically eliminate them? And that fear shows us that these people who are using violence are doing it out of a sense of fear, out of weakness and not strength. Because if you are strong, like a writer, you don't need to be afraid. You stand up and say what you think. You don't need to eliminate your enemy. And that is how it was in Iran. Every totalitarian mindset, every single totalitarian mindset, even in a democracy, their first targets of attack are women, minorities, and works of imagination and idea. Therefore, writers and poets and journalists, they all become the targets of the regime. And that is how the Islamic Republic began. The writers became their first victims. And it is true to this day as you and I speak. So people tell me then, well, that is in Iran, which is run by a totalitarian state, but we don't have that. That is true. You don't have it. And I usually bring them a quotation from Ray Bradbury. You brought this marvelous quotation from James Baldwin. Ray Bradbury says, you don't have to burn books to destroy a culture. All you have to do is to make people not read them. And we became complacent. We had come to the point where we took the rights that people had died for them. They were jailed, they were harassed, they were killed in order for us to have freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom to vote and choose our government. All of these freedoms were taken for granted. And in universities, instead of teaching knowledge, and knowledge is based on our very humane and human traits, namely curiosity and empathy. That is why knowledge is so important. That is why humanities and liberal arts are the cornerstones of democracy, because they teach us, they don't make policy. They don't act like politicians. What they do is help in the creation of an independent mindset so that we can choose our politicians correctly, so that we have enough information. And now we ignore knowledge and have replaced it with our ignorance and with our prejudices. Mm. Instead of knowing about one another, we create enemies out of one another. And that is not just true of the government. You see it everywhere, in every walk of life. And ever since I came back to the United States, I have been trying to defeat that kind of attitude. And sometimes it becomes really, really frustrating. This utilitarian mindset, it's not pragmatic, it's utilitarian. When you tell your child going to university is not about learning, it's not about ideas, it's not about imagination, it's about how much money you can make, you know.
Yeah. And that's, I think also when you are saying the things that you are saying now, does it make you angry, given that you have quite a lot of years been teaching in under the Ayatollah, or I mean in that regime after the revolution, that was totalitarian, and you even had to quit one of the universities and go home, and you went to another university, and you saw how difficult that was, and what you said about teaching literature and reading literature is so important for knowledge. And now at the universities, of course it's utilitarian, but it's also what we will call this cancel culture and woke, yeah, and things that I mean, that is the opposite of wanting to be curious, of wanting to get knowledge, to wanting to know. You are canceling things, you cannot say things. Does that, it seems strange to you, but with the background that you have, what do you think about these things?
Well, you know, it's ironic because we talk about diversity and we talk about others, but in practice, we go against diversity and others. Extreme right and extreme left, both of them, cancel one another and those in between. Now, the whole idea of literature is that it is about the other. We don't talk about ourselves all the time, but we investigate those who are not like us. We put ourselves in the shoes of those others whom we have no idea who they are or how they live. Now, the second thing here, apart from the other, is that literature is not a set of ideological statements that we make. Everybody knows or claims to know that sexism or racism or imperialism, these are all bad, you know, and we need to stand up to them. But we stand up to them by not becoming like those who are bad. If they are exclusive, then we become inclusive. We don't just simply talk about being inclusive. That is why, for example, I choose a Palestinian and an Israeli writer side by side to show what they have in common, you know. And the whole idea is the fact that literature is based on curiosity. It is an investigation. It is not something closed, but something open, you know. And we need to, especially at the university level, because education is the cornerstone of any country, we need to start opening channels of dialogue, you know, and stop accusing one another, even when we disagree.
But you have an experience that might help people understand what it is to be curious and to be reading literature, because you have written the other book many years ago, 2003, but it is based on your time in Iran in the 1990s. And that book is Reading Lolita in Tehran. And can you just tell me a little bit about this experience? Because this is how you explore literature, I will say, behind closed doors. And before we started this conversation and recording it, I told you that I was so angry when I read Lolita. So that's probably how I was able to not identify, but to read about someone who is so disgusting and so provocative in any, in all kinds of ways, doing the things that he does to Lolita. But you chose that as the title of your book, and also you are discussing this book with your students, and you have to tell what were the surroundings of those studies, can I tell, study circle with your girls, as you call them.
Well, one thing that I have to tell you is how much not just my students, but young people in Iran, when they were deprived of the world, when their contact was cut, how they connected through literature and music and art of other countries. You know, Hannah Arendt and Karl Popper are rock stars in Iran. And Margaret Atwood has been translated and reprinted 11 times. So when I was living in Iran, surprisingly and ironically enough, I learned to love not just my own literature, but literature of the world, because that is what got my students excited.
Which books?
Well, they tell me, you know, some people said that reading Lolita is about Western canon. That is because she's an agent of the West. Well, that's not true. First of all, I was teaching what I had studied. I had, my degree was in English and American literature, you know. But it's, that's not all. If they accuse me of that, they have to accuse the Iranian youth of that are so in love with literature of the world that they are prepared to go to jail for it. A lot of the books I taught, we had one copy and we Xeroxed hundreds of pages in order to be able to study. You know, sometimes we talk about complacency and comfort. That is what gets me, that the young people here have never felt that kind of deprivation and that kind of joyousness around ideas and imagination, you know. And I keep telling my American students that respect what you have. pay attention to what you have. Otherwise, you lose it. You mentioned Lolita. One reason I had that title, actually. Well, one reason is I wanted to show people here that Iran is not just the Islamic Republic, that the Iranian people are of a different ilk. They are generous-minded, they are very intelligent, and they can talk of your books as well, if not better than you can. So there was that in it as well. I wanted them to see this young girl who has never left Iran, who can speak and read and write English so well, and who can talk about Henry James the way I had never heard my American students talk, you know. The second thing, I just wanted to mention something about Lolita. We were talking about it before this conversation. And I was saying that, you know, when I read Lolita in Tehran, I mean, when I literally read Lolita in Tehran, I discovered that this book is about taking away another person's life from them, not by killing them, but by recreating them. Humbert, when he was young, he falls in love with a girl, but their love is never consummated, and she dies when she's about 11 or so. So from then on, every young girl he sees, he wants to impose the image of his dead young girl on them. And when he sees Lolita, he rapes her every night and he terrorizes her by telling her that you can't, you know, you'll be punished if you tell on me. So she has to nowhere to go. He's her enemy, but the only way she can survive is to live with her enemy. Now, people sometimes cannot read this book. They become so disgusted and so angry. I think that they can't read it because it's too real, you know. And that is what fiction is. It makes you put yourself in place of Lolita and to feel with her and to feel sorry with her and to feel angry with her. And it also shows us that to be monsters, you don't need to look really monstrous or act monstrous. Monsters can come into our lives because they come in the garb of the spiritual advisor to you, the cleric who is close to God, or the stepfather who is so sophisticated and poetic, you know. And he calls the readers about 30-something times, he calls the reader ladies and gentlemen of the jury. So if you are a reader, you judge based on the experiences that are offered to you. And we as readers should ask ourselves, how many of us have given up to monsters without knowing that they are monsters? And that complacency helps the monsters. You know, how many times a week do you hear people saying, I'm not comfortable with this? Well, you know, they ban books saying that I'm not comfortable with them. Now, if you can't tolerate reality in a book, how can you tolerate it in reality itself? Because Lolita is talking of something that maybe your neighbor is. Maybe even your own family and relatives are. Your teacher might be that way. And we need to know and we need to confront it. But now we are so complacent. We are so scandal-mongering that we don't want to hear it, you know.
Mm. But your girls, that the students that came to you, they were, as you said, really intelligent, bright girls, and they used the room that they had with you every Thursday, as I remember, one day a week.
Yeah,
yeah. And they came in, and you gathered around the table, and you talked about all these different books. And I think, to me, it seemed that, like, by that you kind of made. You made them a space where they could live. They could have something to look forward to. They could be free in a way, because they also, as you explain, undressed themselves and took off the clothes that they were had to wear in the streets, came in, and suddenly they became much freer, also through literature and through the dialogue that you are writing about in this book. And that makes this book, it makes it really special, I think, because you are, as the reader might know, then in Tehran in the 90s, and you are not in the United States as you are now with your American students, and they are free to go and come as they like, but these girls were not. And I think some of the things that you explain in what you just said about Lolita here is something that they have to confront all the bad things outside your door. But when they come in, they are even then able to talk about these things with you.
Yes, and one, it was really wonderful, that space where we could be ourselves. And one of the best things about it was the cream puffs we ate. And we had coffee ice cream with coffee, and I put walnuts and sometimes almonds on them. So we really gave into and the colors. One thing that I noticed was how alike we became when we all wore the black veils, and how different we looked when we each had taken off our veils. And you know that the veil is, I'm not talking about it as a religious, because if it is part of your religion, then you don't need to flog people or to jail them if they don't wear it. Faith is something that you choose freely and is not imposed on you. And right now, as we speak, there are women in jail for condemned to 16 years for not wearing the hijab.
Mm. And you also had trouble with that yourself.
Yeah, I had trouble, and I was expelled twice from the university for that. But just recently, last week, they arrested 300 people, 300 women for not wearing their hijab. But they have, women in Iran have refused to wear it. You walk down the streets of Tehran and they throw down their veil and they're taken to jail. They come out, they do it again. So they don't know what to do with us. I think that is the wonderful thing about it, that they don't know what to do with women. You know, it's great. I say, you know, how much power do you as a woman have that going into the streets without the veil would mean that this regime has changed, that you are so threatening to the regime? It's wonderful, Iranian women, you know.
And then to be an Iranian author and writer, that must be even more terrifying.
But they do it.
They do it.
You know?
So, but I just want a little curious about these authors that you chose. You have James Baldwin, who said today David Grossman, you also mentioned Salman Rushdie, of course, and that is very, very, we are talking. And when we agreed to this podcast, that attack hadn't happened, but it happened in August. So you also said a little things about that. And of course, what he meant to you. And also Margaret Atwood, to whom you return very often. So could you say a little bit about how they managed to resist tyranny and what to you makes them so attractive? Why?
You know, first of all, we have writers, especially during the communist era, we had writers who were called revolutionary. That meant that they took revolutionary positions, but their work was not revolutionary. In fact, it was very old-fashioned, the way they acted with character and plot and everything. And there was always this good hero or heroine who was a communist and faithful to the party, and the bad ones, the imperialists, the factory owners.
I mean, no, it's, I think the authors that you choose to, in your letters, I think it has something to do with their resistance to tyranny or to something like that. But I want to know, make sure, what makes them so attractive to you? Why did you choose them?
No, what I was trying to say is that kind of an author that imposes a message on the book, is a bad author, is like a dictator that wants to impose his voice upon everyone else. The writers I chose all are first and foremost committed to their writing and to the truth. Some of them, like Atwood or Grossman or Baldwin, call themselves as witness to the truth. And what makes them revolutionary is this search for truth, because truth is very dangerous. Once you know it, you cannot remain silent. Otherwise, you're complicit. And as you know, every totalitarian mindset, including the ones here, they are scared of truth. They literally live on lies. The bigger the lie, the more secure they feel. So writers are fighting the lies, you know, and that makes them dangerous and that makes them revolutionary. As I mentioned before, the whole idea of fiction is, first of all, individual freedom is at the center of fiction. And second of all, diversity of characters. I chose these writers whom I loved reading. They made me curious. They didn't give me a lesson in how to act or how to be moral or whatever. They put me within the experience and let me judge for myself what I thought about that experience.
Can you get these books by these authors and also your books now in Iran, or is it impossible? Because I think I remember a talk where you were talking to a person and he asked, if I remember correctly, that he couldn't buy your book in Tehran. Is that...
So. Yeah. First of all, as you mentioned, my book has been translated over 32 languages, but not Farsi. Hmm. That's the tragedy of it. I have been told by my friends that my books are translated but very badly and very incorrectly, you know, and underground. None of my books, even the book I published in Iran, it was not allowed to be reprinted. For a while, it was in black market, but it's finished there as well. Some of these writers, like Atwood, has been translated into Persian, but you know, they don't know about these writers until they become popular. Then they try to ban them.
Of course, they have lots of things to do then, because there are many writers and many books. So it must be a busy job.
Yeah. And I tell you, one of the best things, my experiences, was how when my students who were in the Islamic student associations, they would fall in love with these books. And there have been people in the Ministry of Islamic Guidance, that they do censorship on books, who have fallen for the books. And they allow the books to come out, and then they would be taken away.
But then let me just ask you what your most important lessons are when you teach your students. And another adding to that question is, because since you have both had students in Iran and in America, in the United States, are there any similarities in their reactions to literature?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not exaggerating when I say I've never had a bad experience teaching. I love it. And the students, I always felt that if they didn't get it, it was because I couldn't transfer it to them properly. They had this thing in common where they had curiosity. So while my students in Iran were dying to read books that were forbidden to them, my American students didn't have that problem, but they did want to know. And sometimes they would say things like, why should we read Great Gatsby, for example? We read it in high school. And I would always tell them to read it now and read it without expecting anything from it. And if you want to know what happened next, that means that, you know, you and the book have become friends.
Yeah. That's a good thing to say.
I always bring Alice in Wonderland as an example of a good reader, because she's curious. She runs after the white rabbit, seeing what nobody else sees. She doesn't ask where the white rabbit is going, and she jumps down the hole without saying, oh, will I be wounded, or is it dangerous to jump down this hole? She just jumps after the white rabbit. And then, of course, her gift, the gift of the white rabbit, is the whole of Wonderland. But Alice goes in there, and every character she sees almost, she asks them, who are you? And they, like the caterpillar, tell her, who are you? So the reader going into a book, the book is asking the reader, who are you? I'm going to give you my secrets, but you should give me yours as well, you know. And so I love Alice, and I love the way she sees imagination.
I guess you start your lectures by telling your student this story then, is that true? Is that so?
Yeah.
You start by... But anyway, before we end this conversation, Azar, it's been very, very nice talking to you, but I need you to give me some recommendations for me and for the listeners to read. And as you have put it, read dangerously or challengely, or being challenged by the reading. And of course, I must say they must read your books. And those books are online available. And I think also you might get them in bookstores here in Norway. I don't know, but you have to ask. And they are called Read Dangerously. And the other book that we have been talking about is, of course, The Reading read Lolita in Tehran. But apart from that, Azar, what would you recommend listeners to read?
God, it's so difficult. I always say I'm so promiscuous when it comes to books. I say this and this and that. But
you read something good lately?
There was one book, but you know what? I would like to recommend a book. I just saw it here in my hand people have not most probably read or paid attention to. It's a very small book, and it's called Address Unknown by this woman called Catherine Cressman Taylor. And it is about correspondence between two men. One of them is Jewish and the other one is German, Gentile. And it's a very startling book. The other book that I have been putting by my bedside and reading every once in a while is a book of poetry translated by Dick Davies, who's himself a poet and a great translator of Persian poetry. He has gathered poems from Persian-speaking women for the past 1,000 years. And they are marvelous. And, you know, you think 1,000 years ago, a woman thought this way. And we call ourselves radical. I mean, they are brave and full of heart and really wonderful.
Thank you so much. And finally, is there any hope for the Iranian women now to come out and be free?
You know, there is hope for Iranian women because of the Iranian women themselves, because of who they are. And there is the definition of hope I take from Václav Havel. This is not the exact quote, but what he says is that hope is definitely not optimism. It is not the conviction that something will end well, but the certainty that it makes sense no matter how it ends. That is what makes women in Iran victorious, because they believe in the act themselves. They believe in resistance themselves. They are not worried about how it ends, because the end is the sum total of the means employed, as Jean-Paul Sartre used to say before he went crazy.
I hope that they will one day be able to read your books as well, because they are very, very good books. And I told the listener where to buy them, and I can assure them that it's both reading dangerously and they are both provocative in their way, but they are also very, very good stories. As you started by saying, you were always preoccupied by stories and you are a storyteller yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to connect to another reader like yourself.
Thank you so much, Azar. And spend a nice afternoon where you are in Washington, D.C. And I will tell my listeners that if you like Liberal Haltime, you must, of course, rate us and recommend us and give us feedback using my email address, matilda@civita.no, or my colleague, eirik@civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.